There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Well, first and foremost, as I've told you often, we have to know the mind of Christ, which means we have to cultivate the mind of Christ, which means in cooperation with the Holy Spirit present within us, we have to saturate our lives in the Word of God. You and I cannot be people of the Word unless we are people who are first and foremost in the Word. And so let me just encourage you on this President's Day and every other day to be spending time in the Word. If you don't love the Word of God, if you don't hunger for it, if you're not aching after it, you are filling those spiritual recesses in your life, those needy places, that hungry heart, you're filling it with something. I mean, that's for you to look in the mirror and have a conversation with yourself about. But the reality is you are filling those spiritual needs with something. And so if you're not intentionally and actively filling those with the Word of God, if you are not actively cultivating the mind of Christ in the matters of the day, then trust me when I tell you, your mind is full of a bunch of other stuff. Focused on a bunch of other intents and intentions other than the intent of Christ for this world that God so loves. All right, if you want some resources to help you in your endeavor and effort to be an authentic ambassador of Jesus Christ amidst the kingdoms of this world, I'd invite you to check out what we've got for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We also post our resources on our Facebook page and via Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, Norma Corvey died on Saturday. That's probably the biggest news of the weekend, that Norma Corvey died. And you are immediately asking yourself, who's that? Who's that? Well, Norma Corvey is the one woman whose choice to pursue an abortion that she never had resulted in the deaths now of nearly 60 million other Americans. Norma Corvey died a pro-life advocate, but the death culture, the culture of death that her case before the Supreme Court has wrought among us is incredibly significant. I'm mispronouncing her name. It is Norma McCorvey. You might better know her as the plaintiff in the Jane Roe Supreme Court decision that we all know as Roe v. Wade. She was 69 years old when she went to be with the Lord this past Saturday. And I say it that way because Norma McCorvey was a believer. She was a person who repented, and she's a person who made actually frequent very public statements about her faith and her desire to be faithful. Here is a quote from one of her TV interviews a few years ago. "You've read about me in history books, but now I am dedicated to spreading the truth about preserving the dignity of all human life from natural conception to natural death." Norma McCorvey is a person who, I think it is fair to say, suffered grievously throughout her life at the hands of those who absolutely believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that abortion is maybe one of the highest goods in our culture today. And so even though she is a person who on an individual level came to terms with her sin and her participation in what is now our, in my view, greatest national sin, the reality of what she wrought in our culture is pretty devastating. And so while we celebrate the redemption of the individual, we grieve the now generational sin that she hath wrought. There's no other way to say that. What's the biblical worldview on all of this? What's the biblical worldview when you are taught to talk about the person at the centerpiece of the Roe v. Wade decision, and you're going to talk about the fact that the person who fought for abortion to be legal in all 50 states for any woman for any reason at any time, for her to have repented of that, for her to individually have been at a place where she recognized her sin and her sinfulness and Jesus Christ as the one and only answer to all of that. While we celebrate that, what's the biblical worldview on the rest of this mess? Well, let me remind you of Hezekiah. And then let me remind you of Hezekiah's son, Manasseh. And you're saying to yourself, much like you were saying just a moment ago, who is Norma McCorvey? You're now saying to yourself, Hezekiah and Manasseh? Okay, this is Old Testament. I recognize that, but it is Old Testament with which we should be fairly familiar. These are kings. You can read their stories in 1st and 2nd Kings. You can read their story, these guys in particular, in 2nd Chronicles. If you're not familiar with the fact that 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles actually contain a lot of very similar, in fact, sometimes exact, duplicate information. So you can go back and forth between the two and get a lot of texture and context for every single story, and they actually refer back and forth to one another. So we're going to talk for a moment about Manasseh, king of Judah. We would be in the 33rd chapter of 2 Chronicles. Why are we talking about this? Because we're trying to understand from a biblical worldview, from a Christian worldview, what in the world is going on? What hath the sin of one individual, who afterwards repented of that sin, but what hath the sin of one individual wrought on a nation at large? And then what happens, or at least in this case, what happened to the nation caught in this grievous sin of the killing of the innocents? So Manasseh, chapter 33 of 2 Chronicles tells us, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem 55 years. So from the age of 12 to the age of, even though I'm bad at math, 55 plus 12, 67. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations that the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. So what does that mean? Well, that means that he rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had demolished. He erected altars to the Baals. He made Asherah poles. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshipped them. He built altars in the temple of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "My name will remain in Jerusalem forever." Both in the courts of the temple of the Lord, he built altars to the starry host, and get this, he sacrificed his children in the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. That's like a trash heap, by the way, outside of the city of Jerusalem. He practiced divination and witchcraft, he sought omens, he consulted mediums and spiritists, he did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing the Lord's anger. Skip ahead to verse 9. Manasseh led Judah and the people of Jerusalem astray, so that they did more evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they paid no attention. And so, here comes the wrath. The Lord brought against them the army commanders of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh prisoner, put a hook in his nose, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. Now, that got Manasseh's attention. And in his distress, the Bible tells us, he sought the favor of the Lord his God. He humbled himself greatly before the God of his ancestors, and when he prayed to the Lord was moved by his entreaty. Listen to his plea. And so he brought him back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom, and Manasseh knew the Lord as God. Great news for Manasseh, right? The problem is what Manasseh had wrought through his sinfulness, through his national influence, through his leadership, what Manasseh had wrought as a father in his own home, who sacrificed some of his children in the fire of the valley of Ben-Hinnom, lived out in his children, namely the next king, Amon. Amon was 22 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem only 2 years. Why? Well, because the people who knew God killed him off, but not fast enough. Here's verse 22. Amon did evil in the eyes of the Lord as his father Manasseh had done. Amon worshipped and offered sacrifices to all the idols Manasseh had made. Unlike his father Manasseh, he did not humble himself before the Lord. Amon increased his guilt. Now, the good news is the next king to come along is going to be Josiah. And you and I both know that there are great, wonderful reforms that come under King Josiah. But the reality is this. while we celebrate the redemption of the individual, while we celebrate that Manasseh had a come to God moment, we grieve the generational sin that he wrought. There's forgiveness for the individual, but the damage done to Israel placed them under very real judgment. Why? Because innocent blood was shed in the land. They were sacrificing their own children on the altars of Baal. They slaughtered their kids on the altar of Baal. We slaughter our kids on the altars of convenience and lust. The result is the same. God's judgment on Israel led to the conquering of their kingdom. It led to the near obliteration of the Jewish people. And where the current culture of death in America will lead, well, that is yet to be experienced. But abortion is now normalized in our nation. We can no longer say that we do not know that that's a baby. We can no longer say that we do not know what is happening when a medical intrusion is made into the womb and a child is executed. We hear the heartbeat. We see the fingers. We see the features. We know. And yet at the rate of nearly a million a year, we slaughter the next generation of Americans on the altar of convenience and self-centeredness and lust. Unintended consequences of Norma McCorvey's appeal for her own right to do with her own body what she pleased, when she pleased, where she pleased, regardless of the consequences to another human being. Those consequences may be unintended by Norma McCorvey, but they are consequences nonetheless. Often the thing we fight for ends up being a war that rages far beyond what we could have ever imagined. The death of the individual does not bring the death of the ideology, nor the death of the practice. And so while I rejoice today in the redemption that Norma McCorvey found in Jesus Christ, and therefore I rejoice in her resurrection unto newness of life, even in death, I grieve the impact that her life had on this nation. I grieve the impact that her life had on the lives of tens of millions of other people. Similar observations could be made today about the death on Friday of Omar Abdel Rahman. Again, you are saying to yourself, who? Omar Abdel Rahman? Who is that? Well, you might know him better as the Blind Sheikh. The Blind Sheikh, or Sheikh, depending on you how you like to pronounce it, is dead. He was never shy about being a terrorist. He died on Friday. You say to yourself, why do we know who he is? Well, because he was serving a life sentence in federal prison here in the United States. Why? Because he was a global jihadist. He is a guy who, even though he is dead, his ideology lives on. Before there was an Al-Qaeda, before there was an ISIS, before there was an Osama bin Laden, there was Sheikh Abdel Rahman. And the fatwa, the Sharia law edict, that he set forth came from him. Here is how he responds to being called a terrorist. Terrorist, what kind of name is this? Why would we be afraid of it? Why would we fear the word terrorist? If the terrorist is the person who defends the right, then we are terrorist. If the terrorist is the one who struggles for the sake of Allah, then we are terrorist. We have been ordered with terrorism because we must prepare what power we can to terrorize the enemy of Allah, your enemy. The Quran says to strike terror. Therefore, we do not fear to be described with terrorism. They may say he is a terrorist. He uses violence. He uses force. Let them say that. We are ordered to prepare whatever we can of power to terrorize the enemies of Islam. Friends, there was no global jihad. There was no global jihadist Islamism before there was a Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. The Blind Sheikh is dead. The ideology is most certainly not. Okay, today is President's Day. You probably thought we were going to have a nice, light, upbeat show about, you know, I don't know, President's Day sales and wonderful things you could be doing. Okay, so let's make a transition. Let's talk about President's Day. Let's talk about what it means to be one nation under God as we have a country celebrating in protest that the president is, well, in their own words, not my President's Day. There are, in fact, protest marches going on across the country today under the Not My President's Day hashtag or signage. The organizers of these events say things like this, reading from the USA Today report on the matter. While we acknowledge that Donald Trump holds the current title, the policies he's trying to put into place are not the beliefs shared by the majority of the people. Another quote, we do not accept Donald Trump as our president because he does not represent us. And so I guess the question would be this. Why on every President's Day in the past hasn't everybody who disagreed with whoever was currently the president done exactly what these people are doing today? Why has every generation of Americans been willing to accept as president whoever the elected president is, regardless of whether or not we think that person is implementing policies that agree with our worldview, that agree with our personal agenda? Well, because we're not a bunch of crybabies who are just constantly demanding our own way. We are citizens of a country that has a process through which we elect a president, and the duly elected president of the United States is Donald J. Trump. And he's busy, man. He's been president exactly 30 days. I was going to give him a little 30-day checkup. Let me see my little 30-day checkup sheet here. All right, here's my 30-day in checkup. I think it is definitely fair to say that on many, many fronts, Donald Trump is keeping his promises. I actually think that's quite a surprise to a lot of people. I think that they thought that there was a lot of campaign rhetoric, but they didn't really expect him to implement a lot of those things, for better or for worse. Donald Trump has done precisely what he said he would do in terms of pulling out of trade deals or clamping down on illegal immigration or seeking to figure out how to strengthen our national borders against the entrance of people from nations where, well, as we were just discussing, jihadists want to do us in. So he's keeping his promises. I do also think that he's forcing U.S. companies to think a little harder about creating U.S. jobs, encouraging them to think about doing stuff here instead of overseas. I think that he has created, I think the stock market is evidence of this. He's created a pretty strong climate for economic growth. And so I think that that's going to be essential to his first term success. I think that if real people who are in real economic strain, under real economic strain, after many, many years of no increase in their buying power, I think that if people start to see a real personal, at-home, day-by-day improvement in their own economic experience, I think Donald Trump is going to be seen as, you know, as a great president, regardless of how many people are marching around constantly in protest, which, by the way, the people who are getting paid to protest, I just have to point to that and say, you know, he's creating jobs. I think that those people who recognize that, you know, for all of the things that might be bad about the ACLU taking in $70 million in contributions since the election of Donald Trump, because the ACLU is going to fight so many of the things that Trump was elected to make happen. Well, you know what? They're opening new offices. They're hiring new people. I mean, guess what? That's jobs. So some of this is kind of hard to figure out whether or not they're helping him or hurting him, because after all, when money moves around, the economy grows. And when money moves around in protest, or protesters move around and have to get hotel rooms and pay for gas and frankly buy lots of poster board and markers, then you know what? The economy grows. I don't think Donald Trump, he's a pragmatist. I don't think he cares how the economy grows. If your local Staples or your local Michaels or giggling much to the chagrin of the left, your local Hobby Lobby sees a boost in sales of poster board and markers because that's what the protesters need a lot of, then you know what? The economy grows. So I think that one of the things we have to remember when we talk about Donald Trump is he is kind of first and foremost a pragmatist. Now, one of the things that happened over the weekend, and I don't want to miss this. I don't want you to miss this from a Christian worldview. Something really extraordinary happened over the weekend. When he had this rally in Melbourne, Florida, which, by the way, everybody's like wondering, okay, why is he having a campaign style event? He's already president. Well, did you miss that he has actually already filed his paperwork for the 2020 campaign cycle? And so he actually can, if he wants to, count this as a campaign event. I'm just pointing this out because I think he likes the energy of the campaign trail. And so, you know what? He describes it this way. Life is a campaign. You are always out there in front of people selling something or trying to get them to buy something. And in this case, it's you. So there you go. I'm also anticipating that the month of March is not just going to be the March madness because of basketball. I think it's going to be the month of marches. I mean, let me just go ahead and give you a little insider information here. Hashtag March for Trump is the March 4th Trump rally. So there you go. People that want to march for Trump are going to do it on March 4. It's already trending on Twitter. All right. So in this rally in Melbourne, Florida over the weekend, this is the extraordinary part of this event. Two things from the event in Melbourne I'm going to lift up to you. The first one is this. The First Lady led off the event with the Lord's Prayer. Friends, leading off anything with a distinctly, intentionally Christian prayer, that is a political statement. It is a political statement to lead off an event with prayer. It is a political statement to lead off an event with a distinctly Christian prayer. It is a political statement. So if you wondered why Melania Trump led off or used her opportunity, used her platform to lead God's people in the Lord's Prayer, you'd have to ask Melania Trump, and I don't really know that she's giving out a lot of interviews right now. But I will interpret for you from my perspective what she's doing. She's using the platform that God has given her as a Christian to do something for which she cannot be criticized. And then you say, well, all the left has done since she did this is criticize her. Well, that's fine. You can't plagiarize Jesus. Jesus wants you to take what he said and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. So she's not going to be repeating Michelle Obama anymore. I expect her to get up there and repeat Jesus a lot. All right. The second thing that happened during the Melbourne event from a Christian worldview is that the president made a very interesting, very short statement, about what we share. That we have this shared history and we have this shared providence. Let's talk for a moment about providence. What does the word providence mean? What is the reality of providence? What does providence mean to this, as I will characterize him, pseudo-Presbyterian power of positive thinking, morally flexible, everything is negotiable president? Because providence actually has a substance. It has a meaning. And right after the break, we're going to actually be talking with the guy who is the leader of the Providence Forum, as God would have it. We already had him lined up to talk with us today, and I'm going to talk with him about what providence is as well. But the providence of God is God's protective care. It's a spiritual power that's present in and throughout something. So what does it mean for the President of the United States to be referring to providence? So when you start thinking about what Donald Trump is up to and what drives him and what motivates him and what he thinks about at night, I want you to look at some of the words that he uses in the context of these rallies, in the context of these large events. The word providence is not one that would just jump into your vocabulary unless it had a meaning for you. Unless you believed that God was actually active and present and working right here and right now. That's certainly what we believe. This is The Reconnect. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back and talk more about providence on this President's Day. This is The Reconnect. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hello, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. You can find us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'd love to interact with you as well on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, we're talking about what people are talking about. We're trying to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And so today we're talking about presidents, President's Day. What's it all about? Which one of our founding fathers should we still be listening to and why? And right now I've got a special guest for us to discuss those things with. His name is Dr. Peter Lilback. He's a distinguished historian and theologian. He's the president of the Providence Forum. He's a leading expert in the formation and guiding principles of the United States. He's written lots of books on the subject, including George Washington's Sacred Fire. He also serves as president of Westminster Theological Seminary, and he has been with us before, and we enjoy having him. Dr. Lilback, welcome back.
Carmen, it's good to be back, and what an honor to be with all of your regular listeners and participants.
Well, and happy President's Day to you.
Same to you.
So each year, it's my understanding that close to President's Day, close to George Washington's birthday, which is February 22nd, a member of the U.S. Senate reads Washington's farewell address. This year, that honor is going to go to Republican Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. He's going to do those honors a week from today in this very hour. So tell us a little bit about Washington's farewell address and maybe the first president's warnings to future generations like us.
Well, great. This is an address that he never gave vocally. It was actually published in a newspaper, and it's about 6,000 or 7,000 words long, so it's a pretty substantial document. It comes at the end of two terms, unanimously elected as president. So he was there as the founding father. In his own lifetime, he was called the father of his country. And as he finally is given the chance to retire, he had wanted to retire at the end of his first term, but they pleaded with him not to because there were just too many risks at that moment. So he stayed on for another 4 years. And this time he says, I think it's safe enough for me to leave. But as he was leaving, he was aware that there were all sorts of risks and concerns that were facing the new nation. And so as you look at some of the things that he had in mind, first of all was the need for national unity. He was already mindful that the sectional interests of the new country were pulling at each other. The West at that time, which would take you to the Appalachian Mountains, the East Coast, the North and the South, they all had different interests, and that they were the state subdivisions. Further, there were differences just based upon cultural backgrounds. We remember, if we think about American history, there were religious differences and there were national ethnic differences in the different settlements. And so those issues were pulling at the country. So unity, the union under the Constitution. Secondly, he was very concerned about what had begun to take place in America, and that is what we would call today partisan politics. He had hoped America would be a unified country and that there would be so much patriotism and commitment to the Constitution, everybody would get along. Well, at the end of his first term, there was already a major division inside. As Jefferson leaves his cabinet, there's the struggle between Jefferson and Hamilton, and Madison's on Jefferson's side. So the beginnings of political partisanship. And he saw that as developing into obstructionism and actually all sorts of revenge and division and problems. So that was a big issue. He was also aware that as the Constitution was being worked out, that one branch of government would begin to consolidate power, and he was afraid that there would be an encroachment of one aspect of our division of power by usurping the functions of another. So we might say the judiciary swallowing up the Congress or the president swallowing up the judiciary, these kind of issues. And one of the things that is almost always overlooked when people talk about Washington's farewell address is his commitment to the need for religion and morality being fundamentally foundational to the American experiment. So he reminds what he says, the mere politician as well as the pious person, they ought to be committed to the importance of religion and morality for a constitutional government. He talks about debt and the danger of pushing off paying of national debt to future generations. He talks about the need to be honest in international policy so that other countries will believe our word when we make a promise. And also, not making more commitments than we ought to, especially as a young nation. He's very concerned with what we could call entangling alliances, international issues. And then finally, what is really interesting is what he called pretended patriotism in the midst of foreign influence, where once you have favored nations and perpetually hostile nations, you can actually set up a system where people are saying, well, I'm just advancing our own country's interests by helping our favored nation. But what you're really doing is advancing yourself and undermining your country by this alleged alliance. So he was very concerned that we would be very careful never to make perpetual permanent enemies with any country or perpetual permanent favorite countries, but rather that we would establish our international relationships, not by politics, but by commerce, with trade relationships that would be reviewed periodically because, as he says, as the experience has taught us, there is no unselfish nation. Every country is looking out for their own best interest. And then he finally will conclude with a wonderful commitment to pray until he dies for the success of America. In fact, a religion, morality, prayer shows up at the beginning and end and in the middle of this address, just like it did throughout his work. So that's a quick thumb scale sketch of his interests and concerns. And if you listen to what I've just summarized, you could say, my goodness, those are still big issues today. And so Washington shows his wisdom and his prescience.
Yeah, particularly when you start talking about, you know, global entanglements or entanglements with other countries, and you talk about trade. I mean, these are still issues today. Are there some other things in there that you think historians have kind of missed?
Well, probably the thing that I think is we don't look with enough care at the way he engaged the dangers of how partisan politics actually begins to divide a nation and how it plays into foreign entanglements as well, because a divided nation that's fighting against each other opens itself up for in those divisions for all kind of foreign influence to enter into the country. So just a few examples. These are summary statements. So let me read a few of them. I just jotted down a way of trying to summarize his very classical language, largely developed by Hamilton, earlier by Madison. But Washington, when he spoke with a classical English. So it's hard for our contemporary English to fully grasp what he said. So I've distilled a few of them. But listen to this. The 17th paragraph of his extensive farewell address might summarize it this way. All obstructions and associations trying to control or counteract constituted authorities are destructive of our constitutional government and can lead to its demise. Such organized factions gain artificial minority partisan power at the expense of the delegated, wholesome will of the nation that results from shared counsel and mutual concerns. You boil that down, he says, do you realize how dangerous it is when you start letting obstructionism begin to take place because of political power and associations in government? It has the effect of eventually leading to the overthrow of constitutional government. And it gives an organized minority an unelected power. They seize power because of their political moves rather than by being elected to office. And if we look at some of the political action groups, the community organizations, and other aspects of what's going on, we can see how that obstructionism is going on today. I would love if one of the presidents who have spoken about America would go back and say, you know, Washington actually spoke about the danger of what we're seeing right here. So I think that's largely overlooked.
Wouldn't that be refreshing?
Yes, it would.
Okay, so I went to the Providence Forum website to check out what you guys are up to. So I'm going to read four quotes that you guys are currently highlighting under your banner. And right. So the reason that I'm going to read these four, there's actually more than four on there right now, but you know, I had to pick some. So I'm going to read these four, and then I want us to talk about You know, from a Christian worldview, the difference between the legitimate separation of church and state and what, you know, you might describe as the current effort to utterly separate God from any mention in government. So I'm going to read these four quotes. You already know what they are, but my listeners don't. So from James Madison, November 20th, 1825. The belief in a God all-powerful, wise, and good is so essential to the moral order of the world and to the happiness of man that arguments which enforce it cannot be drawn from too many sources. Patrick Henry, March 23, 1775. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations. Thomas Jefferson, 1781. Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed them from their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath. And then Abraham Lincoln on March 30th, 1863. Listeners, if you hadn't perked up your attention yet, listen to this one. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. So Dr. Lilback, help us understand how this is the language, these were the convictions, this was the heart of our founding fathers. And these are also the guys that said, you know, there shouldn't be, the state should not establish a church. And so what were they talking about? And then what are we talking about today when we talk about when people want to sanitize everything related to government, they want to sanitize it of God?
Well, the first thing we need to realize is that our founders understood the difference between a church, which is an organization of religious and worship life, and a worldview, which is a belief about ultimate reality, and they did not confuse them. They kept them distinct. And so each of the quotes that you've read and we've listened to actually are talking about the theistic worldview that was operating in the framing of the American experiment and that Lincoln was speaking to in the midst of the Civil War. They believed that God was active in history and that based upon God as the sovereign of history and the basis of true morality and the ultimate judge of mankind, they said we must have God to bear. And yet they did not want to say what church the government would favor as opposed to another in worshiping that God. And so another book that I've written has been called The Wall of Misconception. And the question is, in the subtitle, does the separation of church and state mean the separation of God and government? That is a non sequitur. We must separate church and state because their functions are very different. And when the state coerces people to worship inconsistently with their conscience, what we end up doing is that we create all sorts of persecution and coercive struggles that are placed upon the conscience of people. On the other hand, every system of government, every way of looking at the world has a sense of what they believe is ultimately true. We cannot escape that. We call that a philosophy. We call that a worldview. We can call it presuppositions. We can call it ultimate concerns. And our founders shaped, if you will, a constitutional government that had a sense that there was a transcendent authority above the earthly government that they were fashioning. Now, what we're finding, use the word sanitizing. I would say you can't sanitize God from anything. God is the only one that is making something, if you will, healthy or sane or sound. What we're doing is that we're stripping, if you will, the very DNA of the American experience when we remove God. Our motto, In God We Trust, is not an accident. It was a way of getting the fact that there is a government above the government. But when you move into a postmodern, let's say a cultural Marxist worldview, what you now have is a commitment to an ever-growing and more intrusive and more powerful government. Why is that? Because if there's no God above government, government is God. And therefore, the bigger the government, you have, if you will, the more hope to accomplish the things that you think are best in the world. And if you are operating without any sense of eternity, if you believe that life is only the here and now at this moment, and you think the only way you can get advantage in the problems of life is through government power. You want a big government. But a big government begins to take away the very things that people's conscience want to protect. It has been well said, a government that's big enough to give you whatever you want is big enough to take away everything you have. So what we need to do then is to distinguish between God as the transcendent point of our worldview from the means by which we worship God. The government and the church must be kept separate. But the state cannot ever take away the right to appeal to a transcendent authority unless they are stripping us of our most foundational principles, which is what we believe in our hearts. And our country was started by theists. If you go back to the Declaration of Independence, four appeals to God, recognizing that God was active in history. They were theists. God is still moving. So I think it's very important that we distinguish then worldview from worship community. That is two unparalleled things. They are distinct. And the worldview is what each of those quotes are speaking about.
Amen. So it's interesting on, I hope you still have another minute because I'm going to keep talking to you because you're really good on our subject, if that's okay. So when when Melania Trump leads off this rally in Florida and she leads it off with the Lord's Prayer, I view that as intentional and distinctly Christian. I believe she's making a political statement by doing that. But talk with us about, you know, from your viewpoint, appropriateness or inappropriateness of doing that in that context.
Okay, now the context was the one in Melbourne, Florida,
yeah,
the meeting.
Which is kind of a campaign rally.
Sure.
I've kind of described it as his first 2020 campaign rally.
Yeah, okay. At that point, they are not operating with, if you will, government monies. They're actually operating as a political campaign, and they can take whatever position they want. They're totally free. Free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, and those that disagree with it can utterly protest and say, I don't want to be part of an organization that would begin with the Lord's Prayer. Okay, so now what we do need to recognize in a pluralistic society, when we are in a government setting, the government must always be careful to recognize that not everyone holds the same religious views or the same political views or the same philosophical views. And so at that point, we must be careful. But the president or one who's leading, as he's operating as an individual, he does not lose his right of his freedom of conscience to pray or speak as he would choose, as long as he's making it clear, I'm speaking as an individual. I am not saying that you have to pray with me, but I'm going to pray because I have freedom of religion. I have that right. Every president has the right to do that. He does not lose his free speech just because he's the president. In fact, he has every right to exercise it. And that goes back to the very way George Washington, our first president, established the office of the president. He said, we must be careful to know that every conscience must be protected. And at the same time, Washington was free to worship on Sunday, free to speak of God, free to allude to biblical text if he so desired. That's part of our legacy. Now, what we must be careful is that when we're in a position of authorizing decisions and that we cannot impose a matter of conscience or religion on another person. However, because of the framing nature of the American government, it was started as a theistic government, and it has never denied the Declaration of Independence. That's our enabling document. It puts theism right in the center of it, and it concludes with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. That's who Americans are. We can decide to reject the Declaration of Independence, but until we do, this was the starting point of America. This is should be constitutional and legal because it's what made us the people that we are. Lincoln, as you quoted him, said, maybe we've become too proud for redeeming grace, too proud to pray to the God who made us. But we have every right to say, no, we're not too proud. We're going to pray. So that's the balance. It's tricky sometimes, but we do not lose our right to be Christians or to be individual free speech people wherever we are, even if we're in elected office.
Well, Dr. Lilback, thank you so much again for the lesson that you give us every time that we have the opportunity to talk with you. Folks can visit providenceforum.org. That's providenceforum.org. If you want to know more about divine providence, if you want to know more about how it is that our nation was founded on the understanding of theism, that there is a God and that it is God who has made us individually and indeed corporately. So go to providenceforum.org. I know that you can get in touch with Dr. Lilback there if you want to. He's also on Twitter at Peter Lilback, and you can also find him at Westminster Theological Seminary. Dr. Lilback, thanks again.
Thank you, Carmen. Last thing I'll say quickly, the quotes that you were just reading are going to be embedded in our new version of our website that comes out tomorrow, and it's going to be far better than anything we've ever had. So if your listeners are able to check out the day after President's Day at providenceforum.org, there's going to be an extraordinary new, improved, and vastly increased content for people to enjoy. So I hope they'll go check it out and share it with their friends.
Fantastic. Great. Thanks so much. All right, friends. So it's high time to go below the fold. We'll have to go below the fold quickly today. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start or engage in conversations that on the surface don't appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can help change the course of a conversation. And by changing the conversation, you can change the way possibly a person thinks about something. And you and I both know if a person changes the way they think about something, they're going to change the way they live. So there you go. I got four things I want to talk about. I clearly don't have time to talk about four things. So I'm just going to jump in with this one. Were you aware that over the weekend, they didn't discover it over the weekend, but there's a new continent out there. Now, I don't know if it's pronounced Zealandia or Zealandia, but it's Z-E-A. So it's like New Zealand. New Zealand's actually a part of it. So I'm going to say it's Zealandia. The movie hasn't come out yet, so we won't know until that happens exactly probably how to pronounce it. But just get this. A new continent has been discovered, Zealandia. And most of it, by the way, like 98% of it, is underwater. Okay, so I know that you thought that there were matters of settled science. I know that you thought that you learned as a kid or you learned as a kid and your kids learned as kids and your grandkids learned as kids that there's seven continents. Well, much like Pluto got demoted as a planet, it looks like maybe there's eight continents. And the eighth continent, which by the way, isn't there a whole company named Eighth Continent? I wonder what they're going to do. They might have to change their name to Ninth because it doesn't really fit unless they're going to like embrace the whole Zealandia business. Anyway, so there were seven continents and now apparently there's eight, but apparently there's already a move on to get us back to seven by making Europe and Asia join each other as Eurasia. And so anyway, we'll see how that goes. Related to that, in sort of my out of this world commentary, the United Arab Emirates has revealed plans that over the next 100 years, they intend to build a city on Mars. Okay, so, you know, why do people have this desire to get out of where they are and get to some utopian place that would be better than where they are now? And you might say to yourself, well, you know, they're out there already living in the desert, so maybe Mars is not bad by comparison. They intend to build a city the size of Chicago, by the way, on Mars. And they intended to be basically a global effort where global citizens could come and live and get away from, well, frankly, all the rest of us. So they intend for this to be ready to be inhabited by, if it's the size of the city of Chicago, we're talking about possibly millions of people living there. And so we'll see how that goes. Back on Earth, some people are actually working very hard, not only to make a difference, but to make the world different, to make it better for other people. So if you haven't seen what Ashton Kutcher did using his celebrity before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee advocating for an end to human trafficking, I just want to lift that up as a good way to use your platform. Hey, you've got a platform. Get out there and use it to advance the kingdom of Christ amidst the kingdoms of this world. Visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.